This recording is the property of the Winogrand Foundation and cannot be used, quoted, transcribed, or otherwise rebroadcast without the express permission of the Foundation. This is New York Academy of Sciences lecture for the anthropology section for February 27th, 2012, The Archaeology of Burning Man by Carolyn White from the University of Nevada, Reno.
Okay, well, Rudy and Jeff are chatting over here. I'd like to... not paying any attention to what's going on. I'd like to welcome you to the Winogrand Foundation for Anthropological Research and the New York Academy of Science Anthropology series of lectures. I'm Leslie Aiello. I'm the president of Winogrand. So with that, I'll turn you over to Jeff. Okay.
Sure. Hi, I'm Jeff Miskovsky. I'm along with Rudy Gaudio, the co-chair of the anthropology section of the New York Academy of Sciences. And we'd like to welcome you to today's talk. So now I'll introduce our speaker for tonight. She is Carolyn White, who is the, Mamie Clayburgh Chair in Historic Preservation and the Director of the Historic Preservation Program at the University of Nevada in Reno. She also administrates the Museum Studies Program and directs its Archaeological Preservation Museum, where I actually am an occasional volunteer. Carolyn is a historical archaeologist who works on material culture in the recent past, and one of the really amazing things about her and her work is the diversity of projects she works on and the range of subjects she studies. It's really quite amazing. She has worked on personal adornment and the construction of identity in 18th century England and America, on 19th century ranching in Hawaii, on daily domestic life in Depression-era Nevada, and she is currently developing a new project on Mark Twain's original Nevada home, Aurora, Nevada. She is the author of two books, American Artifacts of Personal Adornment, 1680 to 1920, and Chinese Export Porcelain. She's also edited two volumes, Materiality and of Individuality and Trade and Exchange. So she, despite her amazing portfolio of administrative directorships at the University of Nevada, Reno, she's also publishing and doing an amazing range of projects. Today, she's going to be talking to us about her current project, which is an investigation of the built environment in Black Rock City, Nevada, or Burning Man, and the Burning Man Festival that occurs there. Among the many interesting things about this project is, at least for me, its location at the intersection of archaeology and cultural anthropology, which I think for many of us in the room is an exciting space to think about what kinds of interdisciplinary or subdisciplinary collaborations are possible. The name of her talk, The Archaeology of Burning Man. And welcome, Carolyn, and please join me in welcoming her.
Thanks, Jeff. Thank you, all of you, for coming. And I really want to extend a heartfelt thank you to Jeff and Rudy for inviting me to give this talk. It's really fun to be in New York and to be here at Winogrand giving a talk. Can you all hear me back there? Okay. Can we dim the lights a little bit? Is that possible? So you can see the pictures. Oh, great. Come on in, one and all. I can read fine, so it's fine, however it works. Okay. I'm also especially happy to see a number of people I imagine are attendees of the Burning Man event that are non-academic. So welcome to all of you. It's great to have you here. Each August, cadres of staff and volunteers begin to construct Black Rock City, which is located in the Black Rock Desert in northwestern Nevada. Every September, tens of thousands of people travel to it and create the third largest population center in Nevada. By mid-September, tens of thousands of people travel to it. By mid-September, the city is fully dismantled, and by October, the playa on which the city lay is scrubbed of evidence of its existence. This city is the locus of the archaeological project that examines the Burning Man Festival. As a city on the threshold of destruction and on the verge of creation, archaeological techniques are particularly appropriate for understanding the created private and public spaces in the city before, during, and after its use. Today I'll present some of the ideas behind the study of the city and its residents, presenting findings from four seasons of archaeological survey, mapping, artifact collection, and analysis to interpret the domestic and public space of Black Rock City. The Burning Man event began on the summer solstice of 1986, and for the burners in the room, this will be familiar. For the non-burners, this will be the super unfamiliar part, probably. In 1986, when Larry Harvey, Jerry James, and their children gathered on Baker Beach in San Francisco and burned an effigy of a man they had built. The so-called meaning of this event was and remains ambiguous. A number of strangers joined the crowd around the bonfire, as described by Larry Harvey in acts of impulsive merger and collective union. It was that feeling of inclusion, of community, surprise, and spectacle that propelled them to repeat the event the following year. In 1987, they burned the effigy again, building a taller man, this is the 87 version, and once again that feeling of participation and community resulted as more strangers joined the party. They repeated the act again the following year, and again it attracted additional strangers to the scene. By 1988, they began to publicize the event, and they built a 40-foot-tall man. And by 1990, people really learned that this thing was happening, and between 500 and 800 people gathered on the beach. The police got involved, and although they did raise the man, they did not burn the man. So basically, the event had outgrown this site. Several participants in the Baker Beach events in San Francisco knew about the Black Rock Desert and the playa, and they knew that it was a place that, according to one participant, you could sit around and blow stuff up. So they took the man that they had taken off the beach without burning, and they burned him on the Black Rock Desert on Labor Day weekend of 1990. So that first playa event was celebrated by about 90 people, and many of the ideas that continue during the festival happened at that event, offering gifts, drinking, bathing in nearby hot springs, so the latter is now distinctly a no-no. And the austere and unrelenting environment and that feeling of community somehow transformed the experience into a ritual that everyone seemed to want to return to again year after year. Those early days were marked by an absence of rules and an interest in testing the expansive limits of what you could get away with out in the desert. One of the most legendary, which I'm still sort of sad that I will never see, was the drive-by shooting range, where one could get, you could set up a variety of materials as targets. Stuffed animals were preferred, and then riddle them with bullets while driving at high speeds. Other grand and illicit activities, such as fire art, and other destructive events continued as practices that are that are firmly a part of Burning Man culture today. The first wedding took place in 1992. Art and the participation of artists took hold very early. A rave camp was attached to the event. Tickets, port-a-johns, theme camps, costumes, and a gift economy were all established in those early years. Attendance doubled annually to 1996, the fateful year when 8,000 people came and attended. This is not 1996, but it gives you a sense of the growing and growing scale. By 96, increasing issues around the scale of the event and the activity within the community necessitated a variety of changes. And during the next years, guns were outlawed. Imagine that. Cars were restricted. The city streets were planned. And here's a 2008 version of the plan of the city by Rod Garrett. And the Bureau of Land Management, a federal agency, worked with the organizers to permit the event and plan for the removal of its traces after it was over. To this point, the organization really consisted of three people: Larry Harvey, Michael Michael, and John Law. By 1996, this relationship had soured, and John Law split from the group. Larry Harvey convened a new board of directors and created a limited liability corporation. By 1999, the board consisted of six members, all of whom remain on that board today. And the event grew and grew, at first slowly and then more dramatically. In 2011, the BlackRock LLC created a nonprofit corporation called the Burning Man Project, which seeks to, quote, facilitate and extend the culture that has issued from the Burning Man event into a larger world. So a larger board oversees that project, composed of people connected to these ambitious aims of spreading the ideas of Burning Man throughout wide and far, basically. So today, the city is a highly organized affair of managed chaos with laid out streets, a sort of zoning with different areas assigned to different types of theme camps, a large center camp, and no commerce, and a very, very large population. So the scale of this project for your average archaeologist is intimidating, to say the least. It confronts researchers with the inadequacy, really, of research methods that we have to grapple with urban environments. Black Rock City occupies about 4.5 square miles and has a population of approximately 50,000 people, give or take a few thousand, and God knows what it will be this year. The city is permitted to occupy the space from August 1st to October 5th to include all phases of the setup for the event and for the cleanup and removal of all evidence from the playa surface. The event itself is just 7 days. So, methodologically, how does one go about attempting to study a city of this scale? I've been studying Black Rock City since 2006 and hope that the trajectory of my research is a case study for the examination of large-scale ephemeral and temporary sites. So, although I do employ traditional techniques of an archaeologist, the time constraints of the project, the presence of active participants, and the recurrence of the event mean that the execution of those methods is a bit different. In 2006, after spending a field season just east of the playa on my very non-Burning Man-like project, looking at Depression-era mining communities in a place called Rabbit Hole Springs, I visited Burning Man as the city was being constructed during the early entry period, which may be familiar to some of you. Thanks to Dave Valentine, who's pictured in the bottom left of the slide beside me, and Will Roger Peterson, who some of you may know of the BlackRock LLC, I visited twice at that early stage to see whether or not a project would be feasible, and took in sort of the general scene of what life on the playa was like. In 2008, I began to study the festival in earnest and established a collaborative project with Dr. Deborah Baim, a cultural anthropologist. And we set up our kind of sad Camp Anthro for the first time in 2008. I wish I could say it looked a hell of a lot better, but it doesn't. It basically looks the same now. So it's still kind of lame. So since 2008, we've attended the festival together, each with specific priorities, but exploring together various components of the city that make it the compelling event that it is. We've spent the last 4 field seasons identifying key aspects of the festival. The layout as represented by a clock with alphabetically named streets, the form and the presence of institutional components and public spaces such as the information center, the medical tent, media mecca, Arctic zone, which are the ice vendors, First Camp, which is the place where members of the LLC and other staffers reside, large theme camps centered around providing food, art, erotic expression, religion, alternative energy, roller disco, entertainment. Your camp may be shown at any moment. You got to be ready there in the back. And we've struggled to develop relevant categories to describe what we see. We've looked at the range of art installations placed on the playa. Yeah, they call it the Belgian waffle, but don't call it that once the artist is around, including the man and the temple. We've experienced the highs and lows of the weather to include several whiteout-level dust storms that lasted seemingly for days. This is 3 o'clock in the afternoon, as well as near-freezing temperatures where somehow participants managed to shift their attire from fur bikinis to fur coats in some magic metamorphosis, and also experience intense rainstorms that turned the playa to mud. And of course, we've attended the burn. We've observed as much as we can during the many different ways, as much as we can of the many different ways that people participate in the event and the ways that they manipulate and participate in the environment. The short term of the festival makes fieldwork challenging, to say the least. Black Rock City and the event of Burning Man offer an opportunity to examine almost any set of research questions. My primary interests have been to understand how the city is built each year. How do individual people live in the city? What are the material signatures of the lives of burners while the festival is happening? What remains after the event is over? How can I examine the relationship between public and private spaces across the city? And one of the interesting and unexpected elements of the research is the chance to see the cyclical nature of an urban community. Archaeology usually offers insight into a snapshot of the life of the place, often following abandonment or at the very least some sort of denouement in the life of a residence or town or city or state. And the live character of Burning Man means that one is able to obtain information about the processes of construction, of inhabitation, of abandonment, as each phase is unfolding. And although the event is characterized by change, events are repeated and structures are rebuilt and people return year after year. So this rapid cyclicality affords an opportunity to look at ideas sort of gained across over the course of the year and to see those events in action as well as across their life cycle. In August, setup begins. The Bureau of Land Management, a U.S. federal agency, which those of you in the East might not be as familiar with as we are in the West, issues a special permit for the event. And so there are special circumstances that allow the city to take control of the land. The setup phase of the city is launched with a ceremony that marks the placement of the man on the playa, the golden spike ceremony. And this is, you can see the golden spike right there in the middle. That spot is selected through the permitting process by the Burning Man staff and in negotiation with the Bureau of Land Management, and is placed in that spot using GPS. Following that placement of that center point, the rest of the city is laid out and an intensive period of construction begins. Each phase of the project offers its own set of challenges as to how best to study it. Setup is a long-lasting event, but progress is fairly slow and the scale of activity is massive, with large construction projects dominating the activity. Within that activity, there are a flurry of smaller actions on a much smaller scale. So in visiting the city during the setup, you get a very different sort of orientation than you do as participating in the event when it's happening. The mode of transport there is a pickup truck as opposed to the bicycle or art car, which we'll replace it later on. The people that populate the city are a mix of volunteers and paid staff who are building the infrastructure as well as some of the large temporary structures. One of the first things that's built is First Camp, the large camp that I showed a couple minutes ago, where the board members live and other people who work directly with the board. They lived there throughout the event, so that is one of the things that goes up first. Other large structures that are prominent elements for anyone who has attended the festival are also constructed at that time. Things like Center Camp, the man, the temple, and as the event approaches, individual theme camps, and this is the man base being built During the setup, there are a number of key features that really ultimately fade into the city unobtrusively once the event begins. One of the first elements placed in the city is the DPW ghetto. Are there any DPWers here? I want to give a special shout out to them. I love those guys. Where the people that build the city live. Their residences are a bit different. They're typically trailers, affording more day-to-day comfort than a tent or other less robust accommodations for people who are staying over the shorter term. They're also provided with their meals, so they don't need to have kitchens and things in the places that they reside. There's no real separation between setup and the beginning of the event in some ways. As the event draws nearer, the intensity of the construction increases. A week before the official beginning of the event, the early entry phase starts, and people with special passes are permitted to enter the city and to start to build their own parts of the city. People present in the city at this time often claim that that's their sort of favorite time because it's a little bit more relaxed. But the setup phase of Burning Man also reveals the scale of construction that's undertaken to build the city. Heavy machinery almost dominates the landscape. The overall impression during the construction of the city is this vastness of open space against the presence of containers, construction materials, isolated porta-johns, and the empty space gradually begins to fill as the official beginning of the event draws near. Finally, the day or two before, although the festival hasn't officially started, the city buzzes with activity, and you can't really tell the difference between when it this festival hasn't officially started at that point. The primary focus of my work at Burning Man, as I've said, has been the ways that people live on a day-to-day basis in the city, the domestic space. I've recorded scores of camps documenting the different ways that people live. This is Troy, and these are basically condos that people can rent for the term of Burning Man. And I'd like to, this is the guy who was right across from me this year who let me record his entire setup. He was great. And as a means of providing a sort of overview of the sorts of things that I've been looking at, I'll like to show you a couple of these camps, Jungle Camp and Sun Tracker Camp. I'll also talk a little bit about two of the most ephemeral aspects of the event, the burning of the man and of the temple. So this is Jungle Camp. It's a small theme camp that's organized by two people, Mojo and R. For those of you who don't know, that there are pseudonyms that people use on the playa. They're so-called playa names. And these two folks have been attending Burning Man for the past 11 years. They work as greeters at the entrance to the event. And the first year I attended, they had decided to bring along some college students for the first time. So there is a really interesting demographic in their group. Mojo, like so many burners that I have met, is extraordinarily organized in her preparations, in her packing, and general camp organization. And the Jungle Camp possesses a number of key features and activity areas that exemplify a typical but idiosyncratic camp. The camp has several readily recognized activity areas. There are overlapping spaces devoted to sleeping, to eating, socializing, hygiene, and site maintenance, which is a term used by one of the new archaeologists, Lewis Binford, to describe the way that people organize sites in the past. The main gathering space you can see here is that front shaded area of the camp where people socialize throughout the day, where meals are prepared and consumed, where entertaining takes place, and where most of the immediately needed food and other supplies are kept. The space is designed to accommodate far more people than actually live at the camp, and they proudly announce this often when you go over there, that there are far more chairs there than they have residents in the camp. So it encourages people to stop by and to socialize with the residents. And in fact, these guys barely leave their camp. That's a common thing for people to just sort of hang out and see people who come and visit their camp year after year. The sleeping areas take up most of the space of the camp. The RV is the sleeping area of Mojo and R, and the younger occupants occupy the hexayurts in the back that they made themselves, and they have given me tours over several years. And these individual spaces may not seem all that appealing here, but it's very dustproof, waterproof, and quite cool in the heat of the desert. So tours of these yurts shows that each occupant, of course, has a particular area for sleeping, for clothes storage, and for other materials. Outside of the yurts, the bikes sort of mark the entrance. Secondary social space, which you can see a little bit, the back of that truck in the back, is described by the younger kids as a place to hang out without attracting the attention of the front of the camp. So this is the place where jungle camp residents can go to escape the very public nature of their primary social space. The margins of this social space are key storage and staging areas for materials used throughout the day and for occasionally used items. So those ubiquitous plastic bins store food, equipment, beverages, and other materials. And people always think it's so hilarious that I want to take pictures of their boxes, but that is what we archaeologists like to look at, where food is stored and prepared, like in this case. Refuse, of course, is also highly organized, since nothing is everything that you bring in, you need to bring out. So you can see the separation of wet, smelly garbage from aluminum cans, etc. Jungle camp reflects the environmentally specific considerations that imply innovations that a lot of camps demonstrate. Since no water is permitted on the playa surface, the shower drains into that large evaporating basin, which is a plastic tank, essentially, that holds the gray water from the shower and from food preparation. The camp is also sited very specifically within the environment in a couple of different ways. In relation to the porta-johns, close enough, but not too close. And it's also situated on the south side of the street in the semicircle so that it faces basically with its back to the prevailing winds. Sun Tracker Camp is the second camp that I want to talk about. I really owe a lot to the folks at Sun Tracker Camp because in 2008, our first year on the playa, we had no clue what we were doing, like many people who attend Burning Man for the first time. And in the middle of a dust storm, we literally stumbled upon these guys. And it's a small camp that's part of a larger theme camp called Alternative Energy Zone. And these folks were incredibly nice and incredibly generous, like so many people, in giving me data. So for the archaeologist to be handed a drawing of the city, of the camp by the resident, it was wonderful. So you can see here the self-conception of Sun Tracker Camp and its orientation to the street, which is at the bottom of the screen. And you can see immediately that it's organized into these different activity areas. The camper provides the sleeping and eating space, and the margarita bar is the place for socializing. And here it is in action. 3:30 is when they have their margarita bar. There's the scaffolding view deck that they sort of give to the community to allow people to watch the sunset, and they drag it out during the burns as well. They conceptualize the margarita bar is transformed from sort of front porch into social space on a daily basis. Now, the drawing is excellent and to scale, and he changes it year after year to accommodate the small tweaking that he does. But it doesn't quite show everything in the way that the space is actually used. This staging area, for example, where all the chairs and the detritus from the night before are located during the day, is a little bit different. So the practice of visiting the camp is largely reflective of what that map looks like, except that some of the three-dimensional boundaries and liminal spaces are a little bit different when you actually encounter them on a daily basis. So each year I return to Sun Tracker Camp. This is it in 2010. And with the cooperation of Bruce, the organizer of the camp, he gives me a plan of the camp as it changes from year to year. And Bruce, like so many people, is extremely meticulous about his preparation. And he tweaks these fine details each year, but you can see the main design basically remains the same. The apex of the festival is the event of the burn. And there are really two burns that are the apices of the festival. I don't know what the plural of apex is, sort of counterintuitive. So the central event of the festival is the burning of the man. And as I've said, it's constructed at the center of the city, and in fact the entire city is built around the man. On Saturday night, festival participants gather around the structure, and it's burned in a giant display of pyrotechnics that is absolutely incredible. Now, the platform of the man is changed year after year, but the shape and size of the effigy is basically the same. The second major event of the festival is the temple burn. Each year, a different artist or collective builds the temple, and the form varies greatly, unlike the man. So the entire form that this important building takes, it looks radically different year after year. Over the course of the festival, participants make a sort of sub-pilgrimage to the temple. It's located at 12 o'clock, basically, about 2,000 feet away from the man towards the top of the clock. And the temple is a place of great spiritual importance to the participants. For many participants, the temple experience is the culminating event of the year. And before Sunday night, participants journey out here to the temple. And you can see they leave offerings, and the atmosphere there is very serene, very quiet and reflective. So despite this variability in design, the temple is always constructed in a way that so that there are alcoves and smaller spaces for people to sort of sit quietly by themselves. I was sitting across from the woman who left this bead that she cut from her hair in that little alcove there. And people leave offerings in the temple to be consumed by the fire as a way of saying goodbye to loved ones or to mark a change in their life. So the temple burn is the last event of the festival. It has a somber tone, and the crowd is quiet and reflective rather than jubilant and elated as they are at the man burn. And for many burners, I think that this is an important spiritual event. It serves as a time marker on a yearly basis. So the importance of each of these burns is highly variable from participant to participant, but the events punctuate the festival in critical ways. Following the burning of the man, this is the spot, the very base of the man. The next day, burners gather at the man, and they collect material from the ashes. And people gather little bits of LED wire, glass, fireworks detritus, and other materials as mementos and as raw material to fashion into gifts for the next year. So after the festival is over, people slowly disperse themselves from the playa, lining the road off the playa in South Torino in their dust-covered vehicles, driven by their exhausted and elated burners. But this is really hardly the end of the event. It takes the Department of Public Works, under the direction of DA, who's the Playa Restoration Manager, 2 weeks to move the structures off the playa, and then another week and a half to scrub the playa of all the signatures of human presence. Each city block is walked by a line of DPW staff to collect matter out of place, also called problem areas that archaeologists would call features, are marked with a cone, and a special operations crew comes out and identifies those places and does a bit more aggressive cleaning and drags and sifts the soil for large-scale disturbances. The material from the cleanup process is deposited in these massive dumpsters, except for the objects that are scavenged by the DPW or collected by visiting archaeologists. And there's a really interesting secondary trade in the artifacts that is collected by the DPW. So some people collect certain artifacts, safety pins, shell casings, bobby pins, and the crew trades among them for the more exotic items and then rework them into clothing, jewelry, and other mementos. So the process of removing evidence of the man and the temple are obviously a major undertaking during the cleanup. This is the site of the temple in 2010, and this is that same spot after the temple has been burned and then everything has been removed. So when they build those structures, the playa is protected from the intense heat by they put down this layer of degraded gravel. So then that material is excavated with heavy equipment. Here's where the man in 2010 stood. And the area is then regraded with clean fill that's brought in. So the cleanup process really underscores the ephemeral nature of the event. By the time the inspection of the Bureau of Land Management occurs, there are few small pieces of things like glow sticks, sequins, beads, dried limes and other food remains, string, tiny scraps of paper. These are all things that I have recorded. Rebar, tent stakes, zip ties, feathers, pine needles, wood fragments, bottle caps, nails, cigarette butts, textile fragments, etc., small disco balls remaining on the playa. But the effectiveness of the removal of this physical evidence underscores the importance of recording the physicality of the city. So the cleanup efforts that are undertaken by the DPW are finalized with the inspection by the Bureau of Land Management. And there's this creation of the MOOP map. All the green areas are ones that had no problems at all. If you camped in one of those yellow or, God forbid, one of those red areas, you're in big trouble because you left a mess behind. So the special use permit issued by the Bureau of Land Management requires that the BlackRock LLC meet an inspection standard of a presence of no more than 1 foot of trash recovered per acre. So the sites of collection are generated by random sample, and the inspection is conducted with the cooperation of DPW. The city has passed with flying colors with continual improvement. You can see just here the comparison from 06, not such a good year, to 07. So the collection strategy means that very little remains to be collected during the inspection. I've received... Can someone hit don't send? The collection strategy means very little remains to be collected during the inspection. I've received the artifacts for the past 6 years that are collected, and they could fit in this. They could practically fit in my bag that I brought here to the talk. Because so little remains, the standard collection techniques of the archaeologist are less relevant at this phase of the event. It highlights the importance of documentation during, before, and after the festival. So I want to bring in a couple of ideas finally here that I'm thinking about in relation to the Burning Man project. Oh, now this isn't working. Perfect. The work of Deleuze and Guattari and the work of Henri Lefebvre have interesting applications to Black Rock City and its inhabitants. And among many other things, it is an infinite number of topics that one could pursue. There's an opportunity to explore the control of space, and in particular, some of these ideas that Deleuze and Guattari present about this contrast between two types of space, smooth space and striated space. So smooth space is open space. It's unmodified space, space that is not controlled, whereas striated space is that which is controlled and managed in some form. So Burning Man is this incredible illustration of the relationship between smooth and striated space, of the control of the state over the chaos of the nomad. The trajectory of the planning of Burning Man demonstrates this really clearly. The open space of the playa is generally one of chaos. The place of a person within this space, it's untethered, unconfined, and scale is impossible to assess. I mean, how far away are those mountains? If that car wasn't there, it would be very hard to tell. The city harnesses that space. It turns an open, chaotic area into one that's confined, one with a city plan, coordinated by governing bodies. The very first step of control of the smooth space is to map out the boundaries, right here, and then to carve out the territory within it. GPS is used to place the man, and then points are established in relation to that center point to put in the roads and to provide the first elements of infrastructure, creating striated space. As the city grows, the smooth space is taken over by people in many places. So that is some seriously not smooth space. They change these spots of smooth space into striated space. They impose their own control over the space. And then these empty spaces are mostly left smooth and experienced as chaotic space, a free space in many senses of that word. So part of the project here is to look at the relationship between the striated space of the event and the smooth space of the environment. Of course, within that striated space is also smooth space. So if you look at the plan of the city, there's smooth space to be found within the confines of the city itself, intentionally left blank and open so that people can experience that sense of being untethered. The second set of ideas belongs to Henri Lefebvre, a thinker who has applied many of his ideas of mental space to physical space. He offers an interesting mode of analysis for the physical environment and the way that people conceptualize their space, rather than not as a container or as a frame, but as social morphology. And to this end, Burning Man offers a chance to record the form of the space, but to understand the social aspect of that space. So the space of the playa is modified to serve the needs of a group, a very, very, very large group. And this is a fine example of the construction of social space. It's a tool of thought and action, means of production, means of control and domination, and of power. The technology that's employed, and Burning Man demonstrates both super high-tech and super low-tech in terms of technology, that makes the space into what it is during this short time span, and serves to dominate the space and to appropriate it. So the space is taken and dominated, and this antagonistic relationship of controlling that space is experienced almost moment by moment in the space of Black Rock City. So using Lefebvre's three schemes, G, which is global, the public level of the system, which includes things like the temples, and for Lefebvre, palaces, political and administrative systems, we can see that here in places like the temple, center camp, first camp, at the man, can all be viewed in this scheme. The residence level of space is described as P for private, and that this space includes residence levels and the places set aside for it. Finally, and this is an example of P, Camp 1111, one of the most organized and amazing camps that I have seen. This is like one wing of their giant setup. Finally, M is intermediate spaces, arteries, transitional areas, and places of business. So this is the Arctic zone, the ice bender. In trying to understand Black Rock City, this scheme is very helpful for understanding how all these parts can both be separated out and understood to have parts that are also overlapping with other schemes. So here we see, for example, at Jungle Camp, which is a private space, these three different levels. In the private realm, we have entrances, thresholds, reception areas, and family living spaces, as well as places for retreat and sleep. So we have both the private space, the public private space, and the intermediary private space. So this entry area is both intermediate space and public space. And then we have the yurts and other sleeping areas as more direct private space within that public space. Lefebvre also suggests a mode of analysis that resonates in the physical space of Burning Man. He proposes studying the smallest poles and the vastest and most comprehensive. And in comprehending these parts, the parts of space, to include objects in space, he describes as not just the tools of everyday life, of home and work, but also the containers of those tools, huts, cabins, houses, buildings, streets, squares, and so on, all duly marked for and by the needs of practical life. And he suggests inventorying these in a concrete way. And if this isn't the realm of the archaeologist, then I really don't know what is. The second level, and that's something that can really be a struggle for the archaeologist, is to describe the space as a whole, to look at the relations that constitute the society on a much broader level. So again, this is one of the beautiful characteristics of Burning Man, in that it is a relatively closed but massive space. The work of recording the camps and understanding their place in the bigger structures of Black Rock City is an attempt to work to understand space from those two different directions, from the smallest holes, and this is one of the, on the right is one of the condos in that Troy structure, to the smallest holes, to the vastest and most comprehensive, which is embodied by that aerial view of the city in 2005. So these years have been very productive in regard to thinking about the materiality of the event, the shape of the built environment, the material culture that's brought on and off the playa. In addition, the work highlights the contribution that archaeological study, at least I hope it does, can make to examining the present. While some might call this ethnoarchaeology, it's not an endeavor engaged in to understand a past society. It's an endeavor that uses material culture as collected by our tried and true archaeological field methods to understand the culture of Black Rock City and of Burning Man, an event that has already happened and is about to happen, and is an event that's part of our modern culture. So thank you for your attention, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Before you answer questions, let's have Brian.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I forgot.
Thank you, Carolyn. Fascinating. And I'm sure we all look forward to, maybe we want the lights on, actually. Do you need lights on? Can anyone? Before we start with questions, I'm going to invite our discussant to come up. He is Brian Boyd, who's an adjunct assistant professor and the program director for the Center of Archaeology at Columbia University. He's also a New York Academy of Sciences Anthropology Section committee member, and we're very pleased to have Brian on the committee and thank him for the contributions he's made to our program over the years. Brian is an expert on human-animal relations and on Southwest Asian prehistory, and today he's going to discuss Carolyn's work. So come on up, Brian. And after that, we'll open it up for discussion. Carolyn will return to the podium.
Thanks, Jeff. That's great. Okay, I just want to start by obviously thanking Carolyn for giving such a wonderful talk and such great material you're working with. If we were all so lucky. Yeah. Oh, okay. I should know how to do this. Okay, so I'm just going to make a few comments on Carolyn's paper, and I'm not really going to dwell upon the material, because I know that's what you all want to ask questions about. So I'm going to raise a few theoretical points and some broader issues on the Burning Man project and on some of the perspectives that Carolyn has taken in her presentation. And hopefully that will offer a few suggestions for questions to start some discussion. So what we've just heard, very engagingly, is, I think, an example of what is currently being referred to as an archaeology of the contemporary past. This is an emerging area of research involving a range of disciplines, including archaeology. Definitions of this vary, but I think the general consensus is that this is an area of research that deals with the world that we have shaped, that we inhabit, and that we experience through our routine lives and practices. And so that does not only mean the layers, those archaeological layers that we ourselves have created, the palimpsest, but it's the palimpsest itself that's the object of investigation of an archaeology of the contemporary past. The Spanish archaeologist Alfredo González Rubal, who also works on the very recent past, he says that the past percolates. The recent and the contemporary landscape contain traces left today, this morning, yesterday, alongside those of prehistory and everything else in between, those vast time periods that we deal with. And also contained within an archaeology of the contemporary past is something perhaps a bit more difficult to conceptualize, is an archaeology of the future. That's a phrase coined by Frederick Jameson several years ago, actually, in relation to the idea of future utopias. And it's perhaps with these notions that the Burning Man project finds resonances. As Carolyn says very evocatively, Burning Man, Black Rock City, is an event that has already happened and is about to happen. A city on the threshold of destruction and on the verge of creation. So as we all know, the discipline of archaeology deals with fragments, absences, hints, clues, traces. And this is one thing that really intrigued me here with this paper. The organisers of the festival have this leave no trace policy, obviously something antithetical to archaeology. If there are no traces, how do we study it? Or even be aware of its existence? Refuse, garbage, litter is referred to as matter out of place. And this is something, as you say, is on the increase. How could it not be on the increase with 50,000 people there, right? And it's increasing every year. And of course, that then offers an opportunity for archaeological study. What kinds of traces, remains of spaces and places, evidence of activities and practices. What does an event like this leave behind? And what are the appropriate methods by which to study these? And I'm interested in something that Carolyn said relating to this. She commented that her archaeological team had been finding it difficult to, and I'm quoting you here, develop relevant categories to describe what you encounter. And it's that notion of categorization that I think might make for some interesting discussion. I'm also interested in the fact that the organisers of the festival have rules. Certain modes of behaviour are acceptable, while others are clearly not. And I went onto the festival website a few days ago to have a look at this while I was reading this, making notes for this. And the three primary rules, if you like, from the festival website are, firstly, a sense of community. That seems a fairly obvious one for a festival such as this. But we also have radical self-expression, but not anarchism, which is interesting. There's a number of European festivals of this ilk which are characterized by the desire for anarchism. For anarchism at European festivals, by the way, read lots of white middle-class people who can afford $400 a ticket, right? So I'd like to know a bit about the constituency, the participants, the audience, in terms of ethnicity, race, gender, and class. And a third rule is this idea of what they call self-reliance. The festival, as you mentioned, doesn't take corporate sponsorship, which is, again, very unlike the European festivals. Glastonbury in England, for example, has been accused of being killed by corporate culture. So the Burning Man is a commerce-free event, which means that there are no food outlets, no bars. Jesus. okay. And no water, even. And the website makes a big thing about this idea of self-reliance. Will you be able to survive the week, it says. Now, there's a tiered ticketing system, right? So not everyone pays the same. But I really don't think it should be too difficult for people who can afford to pay $400 a ticket to bring along their own food and water for a week. It's usually called camping, but without the entertainment. Back to the archaeology. I'm very sympathetic to this notion of the life cycle or the life cycle or the biography of the site, of the landscape, looking at different material traces and signatures, going from the construction through the inhabitation of the site to its abandonment and so on. And what are the resulting residues that are left behind? That's what we do after all, isn't it, as archaeologists? So maybe we can discuss that a little bit further. And I think that harnessing Deleuze and Guattari's ideas of smooth space and striated space, it's certainly useful for the landscape analysis, definitely. But in terms of the people, I wonder if we can categorize the participants of Burning Man in this way. Deleuze and Guattari in another piece of work also talk about how striated space relates to sedentism and smooth space relates to nomadism. And they use the example of the smith, the metal worker. They say, and I'm quoting from them here, there are no nomadic or sedentary smiths. Their space is neither the striated space of the sedentary nor the smooth space of the nomad. Smiths may have a tent, they may have a house, but they are ambulant, itinerant. So that's just another idea that maybe we can think through. And I'm in complete agreement with your comment on Lefebvre, the tools of everyday life, the containers of those tools I'm particularly interested in. He's focusing on architectures, but I'd also place importance on the more traditional types of containers that we saw here, the boxes, the crates, the bags, and so on. That's totally an archaeological project. I was going to say something about the human body as a container, female bodies as containers, but I'll leave that. This is what we do. And finally, I don't think we should be concerned about not calling this ethno-archaeology. I think there's a slight concern in there. You were saying some people might call this ethno-archaeology, but I don't want to call it that. Because that kind of panders to archaeologists' inferiority complex in relation to ethnography and sociocultural anthropology. As archaeologists, we study everything from the beginnings of humanity to the present day on a global scale. What other discipline can claim to work on such a broad canvas? And we've seen an excellent example of that this evening. So thanks to Caroline again. Thank you.
Thank you, Brian, for some very interesting comments. Carolyn, do you want to come back up? I don't know if you want to field your comments yourself or you want me to do it for you.
I can field.
Okay.